under the overall effort to make sure that the benefits are flowing to the recipients we're intending them to, we want to shore up some of the regs.
The Small Business Administration releases changes to 8A contracting. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, February 11th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, federal regulators push for upgrades to the Trans-Alaska Pipeline.
We're not trying to get overexcited, we're just trying to be diligent. And if we can do something that's helpful to us and helpful to Alyeska in identifying, you know, where there might be shortfalls in maintenance, that's what we're trying to do.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. ANSEP is the Alaska Native Science and Engineering program where every year Alaska Natives from all corners of the state graduate and become engineers, scientists, and physicians. Students can get involved as early as middle school, then move on to the University of Alaska Anchorage, Fairbanks, or Southeast in a program based on skill building, collaboration, and community. To learn more, search ANSEP on the web, the Alaska Native Science and Engineering program. This message sponsored by ANSEP.
The Small Business Administration is changing the program that gives Alaska Native corporations advantages in scoring government contracts. The 8A program currently lets the corporations go after no-bid, sole-source contracts. The changes announced today are its first revamp in a decade. The 8A program's goal is to give Alaska Native shareholders the benefits of their corporation's business successes. Critics claim the corporations get too many advantages over other contractors and that not enough jobs and money make it back to the villages. SBA Associate Administrator Joseph Jordan in Washington says the changes make some basic updates and also aim to get program benefits flowing to the intended recipients. Jordan says one of the biggest changes is that Alaska Native corporations must now report exactly what benefits their shareholders receive.
We really wanted to shine a little bit more light and put a little bit more transparency on that community development and community benefit component. We haven't said in the regs, here is exactly what we're looking for, here's what a community benefit is or is not. We certainly aren't making judgments on these things are good and these aren't good.
Jordan says the Alaska Native Corporations, or ANCs, have 6 months to comply with that change, and he says the SBA will work with them to work out the details. Another change affecting all minority-owned and disadvantaged small businesses that get a leg up from the 8A program has to do with partnering with bigger mentor companies. The 8As can still pair up with a larger corporation on a contract, like Boeing or Raytheon, but now the small business has to do 40% of the work. Also, the joint venture can no longer subcontract out the remaining work to the big mentor company. Jordan says if the mentor company wants more work, they have to bring the smaller business along too.
So those two things in concert, we think will address some of the issues that we had seen where you had large sole source awards going to joint ventures in which a large business was doing a lot of the work, the small business was not doing much of the work, yet that whole contract was counting as small disadvantaged business credit. Again, under the overall effort to make sure that the benefits are flowing to the recipients we're intending them to, we want to shore up some of the regs around that piece.
So far, reaction to the changes among users of the 8A program has been mixed. Three of the nation's largest Native American groups expressed concern today. The National Congress of American Indians Executive Director Jackie Johnson Peta warned that the regulations could be painful for Alaska Natives. But Will Anderson, president of Koniag Incorporated, which serves Aleutic shareholders from Kodiak, says the new regulations should not prevent ANCs from being successful.
The purpose of this program is to give small disadvantaged businesses a foothold in, you know, some industry, some segment that we might be pursuing, and to give us an opportunity to, you know, develop infrastructure, develop expertise so we're able to compete with the larger players. And in my view, you know, what's come out in the new regs really doesn't prevent us from doing that.
Anderson says the new requirement that the corporations list exactly how they're helping shareholders will take more effort, but he hopes it proves ANCs are serving their purpose.
On one hand, it is a burden, but there's a lot of misinformation out there right now about the level of benefits we're providing, and having this being formally reported like this, I think will really bring out that we are providing a lot of benefits and that there are significant benefits and that the program really is working.
Fairbanks-based Doyon Corporation Chief Operating Officer Aaron Schutt says Doyon and partners Arctic Slope and Cook Inlet Regional Corporations proposed changes to the SBA, and he says they support more disclosure of how the program benefits shareholders, but he has concerns about how that reporting will be used.
The difficulty is that the SBA has not really defined what that report's going to look like, nor what they intend to do with the data. So while our three companies and Doyon specifically supports the concept of sharing our benefits we provide to shareholders, we don't know exactly what that's going to look like.
The changes to the 8A program kick in 30 days. A demand from federal regulators that major work needs to be done on the aging Trans-Alaska Pipeline are pushing the line's operator, Alyeska, to make improvements. The findings are part of an ongoing federal investigation that was triggered by last month's emergency shutdown due to a leak at Pump Station 1 on the North Slope. KCHU's Tony Gorman reports.
Alyeska will have 30 days to respond to a proposed safety order from the DOT's Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration's findings from last month's shutdown. Alyeska spokeswoman Michelle Egan says the company had already initiated some of the activities proposed by the agency as corrective measures.
We're, again, preparing a response about the items that we disagree on, and we're asking for a meeting to talk to them further about what they've proposed.
Among the safety risks found by the agency were buried pipelines that can't be inspected, inability to extract or launch cleaning pigs between Pump Station 4 on the Brooks Range and the Valdez Marine Terminal, and insufficient storage ability. The agency also cited the company's cold restart plan's feasibility and implementation as risk. The plan was created in 2001 and revised in 2005 and 2010. Alyeska never used or tested the plan in cold weather conditions before last month's emergency. One group is paying close attention to the findings as it prepares its own audit. The Prince William Sound Regional Citizens Advisory Council is in the integral stages of an upcoming audit of the Valdez Marine Terminal. RCAC President Mark Swanson says the organization is going to reserve judgment until it's conducted. He thinks the order couldn't have come at a better time.
They know there's been a lot of concerns, and we're not trying to get overexcited. We're just trying to be diligent. And if we can do something, you know, with our mandate and with our funding that's helpful to us and helpful to Alyeska in identifying, you know, where there might be, you know, shortfalls in maintenance, that's what we're trying to do.
The organization has recruited former Alyeska president Dan Heisey to help with the audit that is slated for this spring. Reporting from Valdez, I'm Tony Gorman.
Fairbanks Democrat David Guttenberg has monitored Alyeska and safety issues surrounding the pipeline his entire legislative career. He says the federal findings are not necessarily new events, but it is the first time they have been brought to the public's attention.
Alyeska, I think, has a long history of having accountants make the decisions instead of the maintenance people knowing what needs to be fixed before it breaks. So I think this comes as no surprise. I'm glad somebody's finally looking seriously at the problems and making sure they're fixed before more problems happen.
Guttenberg says there have been many problems and orders over the years, but many of them have been delayed and never properly addressed. He says previous delays are now, quote, coming home to bite them. He does not see the need for a system-wide, long-term shutdown of the line for the required maintenance.
Hopefully this is being much more proactive, catching up on things that should have been done long ago and making sure that that doesn't happen, that this is a, not just a warning across the bow, but a standing there in front of them saying, you've got to fix this stuff. You've got to fix it now. Because it goes from being an accident to being negligent. And that changes the standard of why things happen considerably.
Guttenberg says the recent choice of Thomas Barrett as president of Alyeska will fit in well with improvements the pipeline needs. He says Barrett's experience as a former Coast Guard official will serve the company well in dealing with the regulatory process and in understanding the need for safety in pipeline operations. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a rescue near Kodiak.
How many persons on board the vessel, over?
There are five people aboard that vessel.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. No other port in Alaska is building a 100 rail car loop like the one going in at Port McKenzie. Exporting natural resources from rail to ship will be more efficient than ever. A single limestone deposit in the interior could mean a cement industry in Alaska. Port McKenzie Rail, hundreds of millions in state revenues, thousands of jobs. This message sponsored by the Matanuska-Susitna Borough.
Weather on the Yukon Quest Trail turned sour early Friday morning. A blizzard on American Summit has taken a toll on four-time Yukon Quest champion Hans Gott. Other mushers who have checked in at Eagle have admitted that the storm is probably the worst they have ever mushed in. KUAC's Emily Schwing has more from Eagle.
Frontrunner Hugh Neff was lucky to leave Eagle when he did. He said the wind on top of American Summit was extremely bad when he came into the checkpoint on Thursday evening. By Friday morning, weather conditions had grown even worse. Brent Sass arrived at the Eagle checkpoint commending his lead dog, Silver, who had pulled both his and Hans Gott's team up and over the 3,420-foot summit.
That is the best dog on the face of the planet right there. Oh, man, I don't know if anyone's going to make it. Hans was in a rough shape when I caught up to him.
Gott had tried to cross American Summit, but about a mile into his attempt, the drifting snow and whiteout conditions had gotten the best of him.
So I decided to turn around and just go down into the trees and retreat and wait the storm out to see what happens. But in the meantime, I was so soaked and exhausted. It was a pretty scary situation.
Gott crawled into his sleeping bag where he tried to sleep. As the cold settled in on him, he knew he was in bad shape.
After 4 hours, Brent's ass came along, and that's when I got out of the bag, and we decided to hook up the two teams together, and off we went. It took us a long time to get across it, but we made it.
Gott had tried to press the emergency button on his spot tracker, but he unknowingly hit the cancel button instead. By the time Brent Sass caught up with him, Gott says he knew his dogs were tough, but he wasn't sure about himself.
Yeah, that went through my mind quite a bit because I was pretty much at the edge of keeling over. And I know dogs are tough, you know, and I mean, somebody would have found them.
This is the second time Brent Sass has rescued someone from hairy conditions. In 2006, he picked up a fellow musher who had lost his team on top of Eagle Summit. Hans Gott is currently resting in the Eagle checkpoint. He says he'll wait to regroup and decide whether to proceed with the race. Head veterinarian Al Hallman signed off on Gott's dog team, saying they were all in good health. If he does proceed, Gott will drop two dogs before heading in the direction of Circle. Reporting on the Yukon Quest Trail in Eagle, I'm Emily Schwing.
Five crewmen had to be rescued after their fishing vessel ran aground on Afognak Island this morning. The Coast Guard dispatched a helicopter after a second vessel relayed the ship's distress signal. From Kodiak, KMXT's Jacob Resnick reports.
The 86-foot Midnight Sun reportedly ran aground 36 miles northwest of Kodiak, but was unable to reach the Coast Guard's communication station by radio. Fortunately, the Sea Warrior was nearby and relayed Midnight Sun's distress call.
Mayday, mayday, this is a Sea Warrior. That's position 58217315300037. We have a boat on the beach. The Midnight Sun is on the beach.
Coast Guard spokesman Petty Officer David Mosley says the Sea Warrior's assistance proved decisive.
Due to the diligence of the crew of the Sea Warrior who relayed the mayday call, the Coast Guard was able to respond and rescue those five fishermen. If it hadn't been for that relay of the mayday call, we may never have known that they were out there in need of assistance.
How many persons on board the vessel, over?
There are five people aboard that vessel. They are grounded, and our on-scene weather right now is 45 knots northwest wind. Combined sea and swell, approximately 18.
The mishap occurred in Molina Bay off of Afognak Island. Gale warnings are in effect for nearby Shelikof Strait today, with westerly winds forecast to blow in excess of 40 knots. Mosley says Air Station Kodiak was able to send help, and the helicopter was on scene at 1:38 a.m. this morning.
From that mayday, the Coast Guard launched one of our MH-60 Jayhawk helicopters from the airbase there in Kodiak. They flew to the fishing vessel and safely rescued all five crew members from on board the fishing vessel.
The five men rescued were taken to Kodiak Air Station, and no injuries were reported. Four of the men have been identified as Kodiak residents. They are Francisco Jackson, Clint Parks, Michael Hintz, and William Kingery. A fifth man, Levi Russell, was listed as address unknown. The Midnight Sun was reportedly working a cod opener and carrying about 6,000 gallons of diesel fuel. It's not known whether its steel hull has breached or spilled any fuel.
Now that the rescue has been accomplished and completed and those five fishermen safely brought home, the Coast Guard will be working with the state of Alaska and the owner of the vessel to look at salvage efforts, any type of cleanup efforts that need to be taken care of, and to do an investigation to what exactly occurred.
It's not the first time the Midnight Sun has run into trouble. In 2004, it collided with the 85-foot wooden-hulled Rolfi in Whale Passage, north of Kodiak Island. There were no reported injuries in that incident, and both ships were able to make it back to port. In Kodiak, I'm Jacob Resnick.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. First National Bank Alaska, branches in 18 communities around the state and on the web at fnbalaska.com. Member FDIC, equal housing lender. And by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the Trans-Alaska Pipeline with over 700 employees.
The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2011 PFD and consider sharing a portion with your favorite charity through Pick, Click, Give. More information at alaska.pfd.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
Alaska environmental groups sound the alarm about the danger of coal ash in a new report. The report, cooperatively produced by Alaska Community Action on Toxics and the Northern Alaska Environmental Center, looks at the ash left over from coal burning at Fairbanks area power plants that's commonly used as fill. Alaska Community Action on Toxics Environmental Health Coordinator Sarah Paris, lead author of the report, says ash from local power plants, residential coal boilers and storage piles was analyzed. Paris says in almost all cases, toxic heavy metals were found at higher levels than background soil.
Specifically, levels of arsenic and vanadium were found at concentrations that may harm human health. All of the coal ash samples show arsenic concentrations above the EPA standard for arsenic in residential soils, and specifically two samples from the University of Alaska Fairbanks power plants show levels of arsenic more than 100 times the EPA standard for residential soils.
Paris says the study findings are consistent with similar analysis done on coal ash in the lower 48. The study says power plant stack scrubbers that remove heavy metals from exhaust leave more of the toxins in ash. Lisa Hughes with the Northern Alaska Environmental Center in Fairbanks says pollution from coal ash has raised concerns nationwide and locally.
We started receiving these inquiries, and there wasn't really a whole lot of information available. For the most part, industry was just telling us that the coal was clean and we didn't have anything to worry about. So we started asking some questions around town, and mostly about the use, the reuse of this material, and the answers that we got were pretty alarming.
Many tons of coal ash are produced daily in Fairbanks. It's stored in large piles for use on road substrate or as fill for construction projects. Hughes says there was a coal ash pollution incident in Fairbanks last summer when windborne ash from a storage pile spread over the Tanana Valley Farmers Market.
Fugitive dust from an adjacent property blew into the market, and vendor tables at the farmers market were covered with coal ash. DEC did respond to this complaint and issued the business in question with a violation.
Hughes says the local handling and use of coal ash warrants an investigation by the state. Department of Environmental Conservation Air Quality Program Director Alice Edwards says coal ash is currently regulated like other particulates.
We have some requirements related to taking reasonable precautions to preventing particulate matter from being emitted into the ambient air when it's being handled, transported, or stored.
Edward says concerns have prompted talks about additional air pollution mitigation measures. The environmental groups are also worried about soil and water contamination from coal ash. DEC Solid Waste Program Coordinator Doug Butine says the department has conducted its own tests on local coal ash samples. Butine says the test results warrant coal ash continued regulation as an inert material. He says storage regulations may need to be looked at, but that no changes are in the works. President Obama has said he wants to incorporate national parks into plans for helping returning war veterans have success in overcoming physical and psychological injuries. One Alaska soldier is way ahead of that plan. These days, Major Mark Hoffmeister runs marathons, skis, and ice climbs. But just a few years ago, he was struggling to recover from a severe injury he sustained while on patrol in Iraq. The vehicle he was riding in was hit by an explosively formed penetrator. Shrapnel hit his body and head, causing the most damage to one of his arms, which now has limited function. The recovery took months, but as he got better, his wife convinced him to hike Crow Pass near Anchorage. His wife then came up with a much bigger challenge to summit Denali. In 2009, Major Hoffmeister decided to go for it and ended up taking other wounded vets with him. They called the trip Operation Denali, but he says when his wife first suggested the idea, it seemed like a stretch.
And that was, oddly, to me, was one of the first times I've ever really doubted myself. And I don't mean that to sound in an egotistical sense. I've always had doubt, but this was an outright fear kind of doubt. I'm like, whoa, I think I can't do it. I realized that I had to, that this wound was either going to make me or break me, and I had to make the decision which way it was going to go. So I decided, hey, well, I'm going with you. And as that thought kind of matriculated a little bit, I realized also that if I feel that way, then I'm not alone at all in that feeling. And so from that kind of created the concept of Operation Denali, that we were going to put together a team of wounded warriors and we were going to climb the mountain.
And so how did that happen then? Who went and what were the results?
I wanted this to be all-consuming because that's how I was going to go at it. So I picked guys who I thought needed it. I thought that this was something that would fill that niche and get them back on the path. And I elected to make it a pretty long-term project. We're going to get them up here to Alaska. We're going to do a 12-day mountaineering course, get the skill sets down, figure out how we could function as a team, because, you know, a bunch of wounded guys, you know, put us all together. We're one whole person, you know, so we had a few strategic things to work out. So that would provide us an opportunity. It would also give everybody a taste of what they were in for, so they would know without question, really, what the mountain was going to mean. And then take the whole next year to train.
And how long did it take?
Average, you plan for 24 to 26 days total climb, because you never know what kind of weather you're going to get. And we were absolutely blessed on the mountain. You know, what an experience. Incredible weather. Never had a really bad tent day. I mean, we had our cold weather. Everybody does. But we came in right at the end of a very difficult stretch. There had been a large number of folks who had been holed up at 14,000 feet for actually almost 2 weeks. And almost everybody had gotten turned around off the mountain because of that weather. And we came in at the very tail end of it. So it took us 16 days to summit and then 3 days to get back down.
After all that time, not even just the year that you spent training, but all that time backing up to from the time you were injured, what was it like to finally reach that summit and know that all this time had gone by and you'd made it?
It was unfortunately anticlimactic in a lot of ways, because there are a lot of people that I wished were on that mountain, from fellow soldiers that we'd lost, and to fellow team members that didn't make it, because only half our team made it, which was difficult. And it wasn't their wounds that prevented them. It was the mountain. It was the altitude. Then again, you know, there's a lot of truth to it's about the journey. And so while it was, you know, we relished that brief moment on top of the mountain, and we actually re-enlisted Specialist Shabib, Dave Shabib. We re-enlisted him up on the summit, and I don't think anyone else has had quite that kind of a re-enlistment, so that was pretty neat. It was symbolic closure for us, because, you know, for Dave and I, that was us finishing the mission that we'd set out. You know, we weren't able to complete the full deployment with the brigade, but by summiting the mountain, we completed that mission.
When you think back to that time when you had so much self-doubt and thought, well, I don't think I can do this, how do you feel about that now?
Well, it's a good reminder to me every day that goes by, because just because we had success on the mountain doesn't mean my wound has gone away. And, you know, there's many of us out there still, and we deal with those limitations regularly. It doesn't have to, you don't have to be war wounded, of course. I mean, anybody with any form of disability, that's their daily condition. And so I guess what it does is you can look back and say, okay, look, suck it up, keep it in perspective. All right, so it's a rough day. What do you have to do? What do you have to do to stay strong? What do you have to do to overcome that new perceived limitation, and then move forward from there?
Major Hoffmeister is on active duty again and is planning to return to the war zone soon. But he and his wife want to continue helping other wounded vets accomplish outdoor goals. Pictures are at our website, APRN.org. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Tony Gorman in Valdez, Emily Schwing in Eagle, Jacob Resnick in Kodiak, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
And by
AT&T, rethink possible. Details at att.com/Alaska or 1-800-252-7266.
If you are an individual owner of Indian Trust land, an IIM account holder, or heir to an Indian Trust landowner or account holder, you may be eligible to receive money from a $3.4 billion federal settlement. To get a detailed written notice about the settlement that explains your legal rights, you may visit IndianTrust.com or call 1-800-961-6109. This message is sponsored by the Native American Trust. Quitting tobacco is the best thing you can do for your health. Join a free program that will help you create an easy-to-follow plan to quit. It will show you how to get ready, take action, and then live the rest of your life as a non-smoker. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line provides 8 weeks of patches, gum, or lozenges, and quit coaches that are trained to address Alaskans, including expectant mothers. There's more information at 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit AlaskaQuitLine.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line. It's free, it's confidential, and it works.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.